Hey, Dr. Ricketts, it's a pleasure to have you here with us today in Amherst, and I was hoping that you would share some of your experiences in China and thoughts since then with our listeners for Undercurrents. So why don't we kind of start at the beginning? Could you tell us when you were in China and why you went there? What were you doing?
Well, I should start out by saying that during World War II, I was a Japanese language officer with Naval Intelligence, and I was stationed with the Marine Corps. After the war, my wife and I went to the University of Pennsylvania to study Chinese. And while there, we received Fulbright grants to go to China. And this was in 1948. So we arrived in China just before the collapse of the Kuomintang. So we lived for a short time under the Kuomintang. Well, we found our Fulbright grants were useless because of the inflation. And so we took jobs at a university, sharing one position to teach English while we also studied Chinese there. And we were there for 2.5 years. And then it became clear that, we were what you might call slightly imperialistic in our attitude. Actually, we had been quite favorably impressed by the communists when they came in. But when we began to see signs down with American imperialism and all that sort of thing, we began to feel kind of on the spot, and it sort of changed our attitude from one of, sort of admiration, actually, and support to one of at least fairly, I think, repressed but definite hostility.
I'm curious, why were you originally impressed?
Well, the when we arrived in China, the situation was just unbelievably bad. We stepped off the boat in Shanghai to find ourselves surrounded by children, many of those children carrying children, many of them deliberately maimed so they'd be more appealing as beggars. And it was just that way all the way through. I mean, when we arrived in Peking, we opened our door one morning to find a man stretched out, starved to death on our doorstep. And this was the common sort of thing. It was, the situation was just desperate. On top of that, the Kuomintang was so corrupt and so brutal that, it turned anybody off that had any sense of fairness or justice or anything like that. When the communists came in, I had a personal experience with them when I was going through the lines with trying to bring back mail and money and so on back to the university from the city. And I got caught in a barrage, and I had to abandon my bicycle. But I took my briefcase, and I managed to get close to the lines, and the communists waved me over. And they were very friendly, and I was obviously the first foreigner that many of them have ever seen, and I think the first American that any of them had seen. And they laughed and joked, and they were talking and showing me their Tommy guns and saying what a wonderful weapons they were and how America made good weapons, and what a good supply Sergeant Chiang Kai-shek was, because all of these weapons had come from him. And they wanted to know what was in my briefcase, and I opened it up. Well, I had about 50 silver dollars in it. And the moment they saw the money, they closed it back up and handed it to me. They couldn't get away with it fast enough. And if those had been Kuomintang troops, I might not be here today, because I could have been just disappeared. They also, I told them I had to abandon my bicycle out in the field. And it had some cans of meat tied to the back, and I asked them to inform the peasants about it and tell the peasants I would give a reward if they'd bring the bicycle back. Well, no sooner had I said that than three of them took off across the field under fire and came bouncing back with my bicycle. Well, a couple of cans of the meat had fallen off, and they would have gone back after that if it hadn't been for, that I put my foot down. And they wouldn't accept any reward. And what they had to say sounded like, sort of Boy Scout on my honor sort of thing. They said, no, if they wouldn't even accept a cigarette. And they said if they did, they were the People's Revolutionary Liberation Army. They were fighting for the revolution. And if they did anything like that, this would reflect on the revolution. And it was, you know, it was hard to believe. It was so simple and so, you know, it was just made you feel good about human beings. And that was just, but I saw it everywhere. Where the high morale and honesty and so on of the communist troops and at that time.
So I would imagine there was quite a feeling of elation amongst the people in general when the transfer of power happened.
Not necessarily. Of course, some people were very happy, particularly the younger students. A lot of other people had great concerns because they had been, you know, showered with anti-communist propaganda. Some of it ranging, you know, when the communists came in, they were going to communize all the women and your wives and all that sort of thing. And you know, there was a lot of that. But there was also fear they might get executed or they'd be oppressed and, you know, and go to jail or something. And people just. But on the other hand, as somebody said, it couldn't get any worse. That was sort of the feeling. And then, after the communists were in, and you began to see that they were really attempting to doing something, that they went out of their way to avoid putting any burden on people and so on, the attitude began to change, and it changed very rapidly to support. One of the things that happened was that there was unbelievable inflation. Probably only Germany after World War II, or after World War I, could equal the inflation that went on there. Give you some idea, when we arrived in China in August of 1948, there had been a new currency introduced at 4-1. By May of the following year, it was up to 12 million to one. Well, you know, that devastates a society because money is, I mean, you have to spend all your time coping. You can't teach, you can't study, you can't do anything. You're just coping, staying alive. And so one of the first things the communists did was they introduced an indexing system. Established a certain number of units for the price of coal, of edible oil, of cloth, cotton cloth, and of grain, and maybe there was something else. Anyway, these formed an index, and the index was printed in the paper every morning, and if you received a salary, you received it according to that index. Not in the number of dollars, but in the number of that index. And if you put money in the bank, you could take it out. You didn't dare put money in the bank before because it would disappear overnight with the inflation. Now that money was guaranteed, so you got it back according to the index. And within, I would say 6 months, inflation was completely defeated. And it was hard. I mean, there was so much devastation in the country. But the communist slogan was that for communists, and that included their army and so on, you know, three men would have to live on two men's food, or two persons. I get men and persons kind of mixed up sometimes. But anyway, that was, these were the measures that they took, and they won support. They also had unusual ways of dealing with things. One of the common things for merchants in those days was to put sand in rice, dampen flour, take flour out of a bag and then dampen it so that the bag would then swell up and be full. And you never knew what you were getting. So when the merchants got caught, before they'd just pay a small bribe. This time when they got caught, there was no bribe. What happened was that they had to print an apology in the newspaper. And with the Chinese feeling for face, this was more devastating than paying a tremendous amount of money, more devastating than any fine, and more to be feared. Just the idea of having to admit that you were so cheesy in public was terrible. So, you know, they did a lot of things that made people feel encouraged and feel good, and at that time there was no talk about really communism. This was just trying to get the society functioning. That was all.
And then you were saying that your perceptions or your feelings about being there started to change at some point, that you felt that you were more visible as white Americans and were feeling some kind of repression?
Well, it was curious. You see, one of the things that happened was that we used to take the bus from the university into the city. And under the Kuomintang, which none of us liked, but we would go in, and when we got to the city gate, all the Chinese would have to get off the bus and be searched and hassled by show documents to the Kuomintang troops at the gate, while we just sat there, you know, twiddling our thumbs. Then, after the revolution, when we got to the gate, I was the one who had to get off and show my papers. Well, it was ridiculous because, you know, everybody knew everything about when you're, you know, you have blue eyes and a big nose and big feet and you're wandering around China, everybody knows everything about you. But I still had to go through this formal, and I was seething about it. And I complained about it to a Chinese friend of mine, who was a professor, had gotten his degree at Harvard and taught at Harvard for a while. And he wore an American jacket, tweed jacket, and smoked a pipe, and he was more American than I was. I was wearing Chinese clothes and so on at that time, but he was always dressed in like an American professor. And I complained about it. And when I got through complaining, he just broke up laughing, and he said, "Brother, you should have had to go through American immigration sometime." You know, this this sort of a thing. And he was really enjoying my misery. Well, you know, some of that, you know, you took as fun, but finally it began to wear you down as this feeling of, well, they just don't understand. America's not that bad. There's a lot of things wrong with it. And the other thing that you find that happens when you're overseas and other people start, you know, Americans have this tradition of complaining about the government. We complain about the president. We complain about this. We complain about that. But you go overseas and some foreigner does it, and immediately the hackles grow up in the back of your neck and you find yourself on the defensive. And it's sort of a built-in conditioning that happens, and I suppose it happens to everyone. You know, my kids, I want to spank my kids myself. I don't want anybody else criticizing them. Something, I guess it's part of that sort of syndrome. Whatever. I began to feel more and more hostile. And then when it came to the Chinese going into Korea, I had one of these helicopter shortwave radios, and the Chinese had taken a sending device out of it, but they'd let me keep the radio. So I would listen to the Voice of America, and when the Marines were treating down to Wansong and Hamhung, you know, I'd stay up all night listening for news of it. And it was funny because I'd been in the Marine Corps during the war, and I never thought of any group that was any more stupid. Or, you know, in those days, the enlisted Marines couldn't even have hip pockets because they might have something that would be an unsightly bulge. It was just that kind of an outfit. And I thought my military experience was about the one boring experience I've had in my whole life. But, and still, when it came to that push comes to shove, I identified completely with the retreating Marines. And, of course, that didn't make me popular at all with my Chinese friends.
So then what happened? I mean, now we want to kind of come to the title of your talk.
Well, what happened then was that, as I said, I'd been in naval intelligence. And when I first arrived in China, it turned out that one of my closest friends during the war, also a fellow language officer and so on, who had become a third secretary in the American Consulate General in Beijing. And when the communists came in, the consulate was completely cut off from its normal information contacts. When I was out in the university, and I had students traveling all over the country and coming back and talking about what they had seen, and I was close friends with a number of people in the faculty who were in the new government, and there was no security consciousness. They would just talk about everything. And then I'd go in on a weekend and have dinner with my wife, and I would go in and have dinner with our friends, and sometimes with the consulate general himself, and we'd talk about what we'd heard and so on and so forth. Well, this kind of thing you can get away with in peacetime in most countries. But if war breaks out, you're in deep trouble. And if I'd been a German in the United States, I would have been in jail here. Not to mention a Japanese. I wouldn't even had done anything to be in jail for a Japanese. But when the Chinese went into Korea, my wife and I decided, I decided we'd better get the heck out of there. So we applied for exit visas, but they were temporarily denied. And we moved into the city to a little apartment there, a little house. And one day in July, there's a knock on the door, and I opened it, and there was half the Liberation Army, it seemed, with a warrant for my arrest. And I went off to jail. And my wife was placed under house arrest for 14 months, and then she was arrested, too. They were trying to decide. One of the big problems they had to face in those days was how much a woman was involved in the crimes of her husband. Because so many women, traditional Chinese women, you know, they did what their husbands told them. I mean, that was it. And whether they understood it or not, they did what they were told. And so finally, I think they decided that Dell was intelligent enough to be culpable as an accessory. And so she was arrested, too. In any case, I was sent off to jail. And I was, their law was explained to me. It was a very tough law for the suppression of counter-revolutionary and espionage activity. According to that law, you could be shot for a number of crimes in that connection. And but there was an interesting provision in the law. The law stated that if, before the crime was your crimes were discovered, that is, before you were arrested, you voluntarily surrendered and made a full confession of what you've done, unless it was a blood crime, and unless you killed somebody or something like that, you could be allowed to go scot-free. Or, if it was very serious, you could be given a minimum or mild sentence. If you didn't do that, if you'd been arrested, then you were faced with a choice. You either went through, and this is assuming that it wasn't a blood crime, because if it were, if you'd killed somebody, you were liable to be executed. But if it was anything less than that, you had a choice. You could either make a full confession and undergo reform, or if you refused to confess and refused to reform, you would be tried by a military tribunal and taken out and executed, if that was the punishment that they felt was appropriate. So I, of course, at first tried to deny things, but it's pretty silly because, as I said, when you're a foreigner wandering around China, you're pretty obvious. They knew a great deal about me. The big question was they didn't know how much they knew about me. You know, that there could have been more that they didn't know about. So they pushed pretty hard. I was interrogated night and day. First I tried to, and very skillfully, I'd been an interrogation officer myself during the war. I interrogated Japanese prisoners, so I had some idea about techniques. And they kept me completely off balance. I started out by trying to deny what I, well, admit what I knew they knew and deny what I thought they didn't know. The problem was that after a while I got so confused I was admitting things I swore I'd never admit and denying things that I'd already admitted. And finally, after about 12 days, I said, the hell with it, and just gave a full confession. And then I was ordered to write out my confession, which I did. I spent something like 87 handwritten pages writing out my confession, most of which was to explain to them that it really wasn't my fault, whatever had happened. And that I wasn't a bad guy. Then I was told I'd have to take part in reform. Incidentally, I rewrote my confession every year. I was told to rewrite it. I wasn't told what to say. I was just told to rewrite it. Second year, I thought, well, you know, I'm in for this far. I might as well give them go whole hog. So I accepted blame for everything. I was willing to accept the blame for the Korean War if that was necessary. And I got that one bounced right back to me. They said, this is stupid, this is dangerous, you can hurt other people as well as yourself. And what we want to know is just exactly the truth and nothing more. In the third year, I redid it. By the fourth year, I was down to 12 pages. I just stated what I'd done and when I'd done it, and that was it. No excuses, no rationalizations or anything of that kind. And it was important to them that you do a confession that was absolutely right on the money, because they're not pushing it too far, not accepting blame for things that weren't your fault. Because, as they pointed out, if a man steals $99, but you accuse him of stealing $100, the one thing he'll think about is the $1 he didn't steal, not the $99 that he did. And use that as a rationalization for resisting any kind of, you know, criticism or reform or what have you. So I did the confessions. And then I took part in this reform. And the reform consisted of a process, something like group therapy in the United States, except it wasn't as well controlled. We sat around as a group. And the cell that I was in was about 8 by 10. And about two-thirds of it was covered by the wooden platform, about 2.5 feet off the ground. And on that, we would roll on our bedding and sleep at night, and we'd sit cross-legged on it during the day. And there's a little space for walking up and down, and there was a bucket, there's a latrine in the corner, and we got a major latrine call twice a day, and we got fed twice a day. All we wanted to eat, the food was simple, tended to be rough grains, either millet or they had a steamed cornbread that we would get, and then we would get vegetables in a soup, and the vegetables varied as the seasons went by because they didn't have refrigeration and things like that. And actually, in the wintertime, it was mostly Chinese cabbage, and I can tell you got awful sick of Chinese cabbage by January and February. But that was the diet, but it was essentially a healthy diet. Conditions in the prison were terrible when we first went in. This was an old Kuomintang prison that had been taken over by the communists. When I first went in, they ran it pretty much in the traditional Chinese, the way traditional Chinese prisons were run, and that is you appoint a cell leader, a tough guy, usually the meanest, worst guy in the whole place. You appoint him as a cell leader, and then he maintains discipline in the cell. Out of that, he gets all sorts of perks. Anything that comes into the cell in the way of food or something like that, he gets his share of, and so on. But that was a good way of controlling the prisoners. Later on, they did away with that system. Once they began to really get control of things. Another thing was that the rats and, you know, were all over the place. We were all covered. We were covered with fleas and lice and bed bugs we didn't get baths. We could wash. There's a little wash basin. We could bring in water and wash, but you didn't get baths. Didn't get haircuts, and of course my beard was pretty long. I managed to keep my mustache down by chewing it off, but that was about the best I could do. It was a pretty bad place. But after the first year, there was a big health movement in China because of the threat of germ warfare in Korea. And they really cleaned up the place. We divided ourselves in the cell into ground observers and attacking force to go after the flies and bugs and so on. And then we'd knock them down and we'd put them in a bottle and run competitions with the other cells to see who could get the most. And it was, you know, suddenly we were taking baths and getting haircuts and bath about once every 6 weeks. That may not seem much, but I can tell you when it happens, it's pretty good.
So one thing I wanted to clarify, it sounds like this is kind of what we would call today lockdown. So you essentially never left the cell?
We did. After the first year, we would get a couple of times a week to go out in the courtyard as an individual cell. Remember, this is a maximum security prison. We were not supposed to know who was in any of the other cells, and because, you know, there were espionage networks and all sorts of things going on. So this was a maximum security detention quarters. Now, it was primarily for the processing of cases. Most foreigners actually stayed there the whole length of their sentence, rather than being sent on to regular Chinese prisons or prison farms or whatever other form of punishment there might be. So it was a very tough prison. Oddly enough, the door was made of wood, a lattice wood with just a bolt. And in the early years, they didn't know what to do with the children of women who were there. I mean, if they had relatives, they'd place the children with them. But if they weren't, they didn't know what to do with them. So the children just stayed in the prison. And the children would go wandering around, opening doors and coming in and talk to you. And you wouldn't think of trying to escape because they told you, quite frankly, you can escape anytime you want to. This is not it isn't that impossible to escape. But if you do, we'll have you back within a very short time. We'll shoot you. No question about it. That's it. And so none of us tried it. So anyway, then began this question of thought reform. So we sat around in a circle on this. It was called a cog, this sort of platform, and we did a number of things. One of the things we do, we would have study set periods in which we would study about socialism or women's rights or, any of the issues that came along during the time. We would read documents. Well, most of the people are illiterate, so we would read them aloud. We would go through a regular reading, and then we would go through a fast reading, that would be called, and then we'd go through slow readings in which you would, maybe paragraph by paragraph, and you would discuss these things and so on. And then after that, you would discuss how you felt about these things. And, of course, what was interesting was that you found immediately there was a wide range of opinion in the cell. We were all anti-communists. There's no question about that. But that we were, for instance, several of the people were landlords, and they couldn't understand what they had done that was terribly wrong. Well, when any one of them would try to justify charging the peasants something like 100 to 125% interest in the spring of the year when the old grain has gone out and the new grain hasn't come in yet and the peasants are starving and they need seed grain in order to survive, I, as an American, that didn't sit well with me at all. On the other hand, every time I opened my mouth, this stupid landlord could hear American imperialism coming out. It was just that way. And so there was a lot of discussion that went on that was real discussion. Of course, we all, when we first went in, tried to claim that, that we loved communism, we loved socialism, land reform was great, all that sort of thing. But then, the communists simply pointed out if we really felt that way, we shouldn't be in the prison to begin with. So how did we get there if that was how we felt about it? So, you had to be somewhat realistic. And then we began dealing with, more personal problems of really how you felt about things. And a lot of the discussion was sort of pointless, but some of it really sort of hit the mark. For example, the first time we were told we should discuss women's rights. If you can imagine a group of about 8-10 men sitting around in a circle being told they have to discuss women's rights. Well, our feeling was, if they want them, let them have them. I mean, and we, we'd all been married at least 5 years, and our wives were happy. There was no problem with our wives, what was the big deal? Well, anyway, something happened one day that changed that, and that was that one of the fellows was called out of the cell, and when he came back, he was looking very grim, and it turned out his wife had asked him for a divorce. And when we asked him about it, how he felt about it, his response was typical male. He didn't care. He'd been fed up with her for a long time, and he'd have kicked her out if he hadn't been so soft-hearted and so on and all that sort of thing. In those days, you could kick out a wife under the Kuomintang. Anyway, it obviously didn't solve his problem because he kept walking up and pacing up and down the cell, bumping into things, staring off into space, and he was really upset. So one day, when we asked him about it, and our study sessions, ranged from about 6:30 in the morning Well, we got up at 6:30, and then we washed and so on. By 7, we were on. We started our discussions. They went to about 9 when we had breakfast, and then from about 10 through until about 2 in the afternoon, 2:30 in the afternoon, when we would then have our second meal, and then we would have rest until about 6, and then we would talk until about 9. So there's a lot of discussion went on. And so anyway, what happened was that he said, you know, once that he really couldn't understand it because they'd always had such a happy marriage, why his wife would be leaving him. So we decided to discuss this happy marriage, and we got talking about it. Well, one of the things that happened, came up almost immediately, was that he had married his wife up in Manchuria. At that time, he'd been working in a bank up there. And he had turned Christian in order to marry his wife, who was a Christian convert. And shortly after the marriage, his wife's younger sister had come to live with him so she could go to school in Mukden. And he'd sort of taken her as a concubine. And his wife definitely was not happy about that. In fact, he said she'd cried solidly for a month or so, and kicked up such a fuss that finally he had solved the problem by marrying the younger girl off to a friend of his in a bank. And this sort of things like that kept popping up. Perhaps the worst was that, one of the worst was that shortly, right before liberation, he was at that time a captain in the Kuomintang secret police. Their youngest daughter took ill, and his wife wanted him to take the child to the hospital. Then he said, and he would know, he felt it was just a common cold. Besides, he was busy. He was going off to play poker. The Chinese are fanatics on poker. Anyway, he went off to play poker. He was gone for 3 days, came back. He'd lost his shirt. The child was dead. It turned out it was encephalitis. When his wife couldn't stop her crying, he'd had to slap her around a little bit. And he'd had to pawn her wedding ring to buy a coffin for the child because he had lost his shirt in a poker game. And as you can see, it was a very happy marriage. Well, we spent about a little over 2 weeks discussing his happy marriage. And, you know, it took that long before the guy could see any reason at all why his wife might want to divorce him. Even then, he never brought up the fact that the reason he was in prison was because when the Chinese went into North Korea, he thought that there was going to be an American landing in North Korea very quickly. And so he and some of his friends decided to organize sort of a welcoming committee. And to prove their diligence and loyalty, they set a small hotel on fire that happened to have some communists living in it. And for this bit of brilliance, he was now spending the rest of his life perhaps in prison or being executed. And, of course, his wife had never been consulted in this at all. She just had to support the family on her own and so on. So she was getting a divorce. Well, anyway, after we got through with his happy marriage, then we went into all our happy marriages. And it was a good 6 weeks that we spent on our happy marriages. All of us, as I said, had been married at least 5 years. All of us... Well, we had to admit that perhaps the worst we, however, couldn't imagine it to begin with was that, you know, we hadn't helped our wives with the dishes or something of that kind. Trivial stuff, but actually very quickly it came out it was much more serious than that. It turned out I was the only person in the cell who had never struck his wife. And they said the only reason I hadn't was because I didn't dare. One fellow had kicked out his first wife, a peasant woman, married a sing-song girl who has turned out to be tubercular. He mistreated her so badly she threatened to commit suicide, so he handed her a knife and told her to go out and do it and get out of his sight and stay out, and that was the end of that. One after another story of that kind. And by the time the discussion was over, you know, as far as really getting it, none of us did. But we did, I think, begin to realize that if we ever did get back home, and we ever did, and our wives were still with us, we were going to have to adopt a slightly different attitude. And it was the beginnings of something. And I think as much as these things can, it was fairly effective. Now, the thing about it is, of course, is that there's no such thing as final reform. You know, you don't, for instance, an alcoholic or somebody like that who comes home drunk, beats up on his wife, and then the next day is terribly remorseful about it and so on. He can feel terrible about it, but that doesn't mean that he's going to reform, that he's reformed. The only way, as they pointed out, that you really reform is, first of all, you have to really realize that what you've been doing is wrong. That you have to be totally convinced of. That was about the best you could do under this criticism and self-criticism that went on. But to really reform, you just had to build a new life in which the old ways of doing things were just unthinkable because your mind was occupied with new things, that you were building something new, devoted to something new, and you were happy about doing something new, so that the temptation to be what you were before just didn't exist. And that's the way, that's real reform. That's when it really happens. But we're all dependent on our environment. And so much of what happens to you as an individual depends upon the environment that you're in. And this was stressed very much there. And so the idea was that in this reform process was that you would learn that. You would learn skills so that you could be a productive member of the society. And then when you were released, you would go back to a community in which the rest of the country had also gone through a process of reform, not in prison, but had been reforming too, so that you would be able to fit into the society and be a part of it. Now, that was a somewhat idealistic view because people that I know that had experience said, well, that's true. People were maybe willing to forgive but not necessarily forget. So that it always was a hard struggle. You really had to continually prove yourself, and it was difficult. But still, people made it. One of the problems was that as time went on, there were new political movements in which strong anti-rightism became the target. There was the anti-rightist movement, and then of course there was the Cultural Revolution and all of that. And people who had any kind of a record tend to get caught up in it. So there were, it didn't always work the way it should, but I think the impact on the people was tremendous. And there were several studies that were done of people who went down to Hong Kong, you know, after having gone through the process in China. And the conclusion was that no matter how these people may have felt about the mainland government, they had been very strongly affected by the prison experience, and in ways that stuck with them, you know, in terms of moral values, things of that kind.
So we should certainly let our listeners know what finally happened, at least in your particular case. How long did you spend in prison? Did you decide that you were reformed? Did your jailers decide that you were reformed?
Well, as I said, my wife was under arrest for 14 months, and then she went to the same prison. We never saw each other while we were in prison. We could write. And some people felt that was rather cruel, but then a girl never looks her best in prison anyway, so perhaps it was just as well. But in any end, it would certainly have just created problems, you know, because if you can't be together, sometimes it's better just to be apart. But she was released, and she was given the minimum sentence of 3.5 years, and she was released at the beginning of, in February of 1955. I was released in September of 55 because of an agreement that was signed between China and the United States in which Chinese being held in this country would be allowed to return to China, and Americans being held there would be allowed to go. So I was released as part of that. But I went through a civil trial. The early trials were all military, but by that time they switched to civil trial. I went through a civil trial. I had a lawyer. He pleaded for me on the basis that I had been a good prisoner and I'd shown interest in reforming. And so I was given the minimum sentence, in my case 10 years. And then I was taken into another room where they had a parole board and given immediate release. But I went through the full process. The Chinese were not going to give up. Even though it was cut and dried that I was going to be released, I don't know what would happen if I had pleaded not guilty. But I pleaded guilty, so everything worked out fine. And I was released and then came back to the United States. And it was very interesting coming back here. I had created quite a stir when I went into Hong Kong because, both my wife and I did, because when we came out, we refused to go along with what was expected of us, and that was to say that we had been falsely accused and badly treated and all of that. We said that we'd been fairly treated and that we were guilty of as charged, that we'd done what we, that we'd committed crimes. And so we were immediately labeled as brainwashed. The gentlest people toward us actually was Time Magazine. It was very interesting. Time Magazine wrote about me that the communists hadn't brainwashed me so much as they had just stopped my clock, that I sounded like a 1940s liberal. And which was very, very interesting. Anyway,
it's probably the most far-out phrase I've come up with.
Anyway, we came back, and it was amazing the amount of support we got from people. You know, people told us, you'll never get another job, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I went back to the University of Pennsylvania, and they said, well, the department said, you know, we welcome you back. You'll never get a job, but we'd certainly love to have you. So we went back, and I got my Ph.D., and by the time I got my Ph.D., the country had had 10 years without training anyone in Chinese studies, Chinese language, and so on. They'd had political scientists, but no one who was really into Chinese language and civilization. So I did my choice of jobs. In fact, I came up here to Amherst and was interviewed here in Amherst. But I finally decided to stay at Penn. Actually, we had when we first came back, we felt, you know, we could live on millet and so on. And we got involved in various causes and so on and so forth. But then if we found that we had to have a car because in order to get around to the speaking engagements and so on, and one thing led to another, and pretty soon we ended up with a nice, comfortable bourgeois life. But I would say that, though, that the effects of that experience stay with me today. You know, the first place, one of the things that you learned in that prison is you can no longer fool yourself. One of the things that you do is rationalize. You know, you can rationalize anything, any pattern of behavior and so on. One of the things that we got from that experience was to realize how you rationalize. Because you had your rationalizations destroyed in this process of criticism and self-criticism. And so it's not that easy to fool yourself anymore.